Welcome to the Lighthouse Faith Podcast, Moving Forward in Truth and Love. I'm Lauren Green, Chief Religion Correspondent for Fox News Channel and author of the book, Lighthouse Faith. Well, conspiracy theories are in endless supply these days, from the shooting of JFK to speculations about, you know, Area 51 or Area 54 or whatever it is, and even about 9/11. But what about the Catholic Church? Is there a conspiracy to bring it down? The clergy abuse crisis has weakened the church's authority, made younger Catholics pull away from the faith, and caused the culture really in general to believe the church is filled with priests abusing children. Well, listen to this. When C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Screwtape Letters, it's a fictional account of a senior devil agent writing to a junior devil agent about how to corrupt the creation of the enemy. And the enemy, of course, is God, and his creation is us, humanity. But in the book's epilogue, there is a banquet of Satan's followers, and they drink to the fine wine, get this, of Pharisee and priest, because they say the best way to corrupt God's creation is at the altar. Now, even if you don't believe in God or Satan or evil forces attacking the church, there is a crumbling or decaying of the church from the inside. And that's what my guest today believes is happening, that two scores of centuries of forces from the outside, from Nero to Napoleon, have tried and failed to bring the church down. But it's the forces from the inside that appear to be what's causing its downfall right now. Dr. Taylor Marshall has written a book called Infiltration, The Plot to Destroy the Church from Within. He's here. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
And you've got your two lovely daughters and your son here. I did meet Rose and Mary. Yep. And then who is this young man?
This is Jude.
Hey, Jude. Like, how often have you heard that? Of course, you're too young to even know where that comes from. So, a lot of journalists and people would dismiss your book because, you know, there's a disbelief in the spiritual element, you know, the forces within. It comes to people's bad behavior. You know, while a lot of people may believe in God, they have a hard time believing in a Satan or evil forces or spiritual forces at work in the world. And that's why we have a justice system. So people are forced to take responsibility for criminal behavior. And I'm all for that. We don't say, well, the devil made me do it, and so that, you know, I shouldn't be held responsible. That's not the way this works. But you say early on in the book that if you don't believe in Satan, if you don't believe Satan exists, just don't read this book.
That's right.
Yeah. Why do you say that? I want your explanation.
Well, we have to remember that, you know, from the Christian point of view, going back from, well, before the beginning of time, there is the fall of the angels. Lucifer and a third of the angels fell. And then all the way up until the time of Christ, you know, there was all these betrayals, right, that were spiritual in nature. And then, you know, especially at the Last Supper, which we've seen in so much art, you know, there's always in the peripheral there, there's Judas Iscariot. And sometimes he has a little devil on his shoulder,
right?
That's how
right.
Usually artists, especially in the Renaissance, depicted him. And that's showing that there is it's a personal, friendly infiltration of an actual friend of Christ, Judas Iscariot. But there's also this metaphysical or a spiritual infiltration that's going along with it. And from the Christian point of view, that's always been there because Christ talks about the devil and he talks about him influencing people and, you know, even up to the leading of his death and all that.
He talks about the devil a lot.
A whole lot. And it's really difficult to kind of make that go away. So Christians have always held that. And so if you want to look at the current crisis, you know, you can't just point to policies or a bad bishop here and a bad – of course, all those things are true, canon law. But there's also a spiritual element to it. And
right.
My book is primarily a history of the last 175 years, but also connecting it along the way with a spiritual infiltration within
right.
the very walls and the heart of the church.
Yeah. You know, you bring out one of the verses that really spells it out. And what people don't understand is that the Bible itself talks about spiritual forces of evil, that they're rampant in this world. And Ephesians 6:12 also brings it out, for we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against spiritual hosts of wickedness. I mean, this is plain and simple that the Bible understands that we are not wrestling with just people, but people who are being influenced by a spiritual force.
Precisely. And sometimes, you know, when we see these stories breaking about these corrupt cardinals and the financial scandals and the sexual scandals, sometimes we do need to step back and say, okay, well, what can I do? And sometimes people think that's writing letters or protesting. But there's also just, I think, from a Christian point of view, hitting your knees and praying and realizing that mm-hmm. we're up against these spiritual, as you say, as you read in Ephesians, these these principalities and this domination. So, yeah, if you're not into that and you don't believe that that's for real, this book would probably not be that interesting to you, because along the way that is discussed within the context of history.
You know, there is this sort of saying, if you don't believe Satan exists, he's already got you.
Right.
You know, basically.
Yes, exactly. And I like the quote there that he had from C.S. Lewis in the intro on the Screwtape Letters, that the most powerful way to draw people away from God is to attack those who represent God.
Right.
Whether it would be, you know, a priest or a clergyman or a minister or a cardinal.
Right.
Or go all the way to the top. You know, that this is always the most scandalous to people.
The proverbial sheep in wolf's clothing. I mean, wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah, that's right.
The other way around. Whoa. This whole idea of the spiritual forces, it brings up a very uncomfortable quandary for modern people. You know, if you're not bowing down to God, you're bowing to something else, yourself, which leaves you unprotected against the powers of evil, in a sense. I mean, it really does. And I think this is where we kind of have a problem. You know, it's this sort of, you know, I'm a free person. I can decide for myself what is right or wrong. And this is the problem for modern people, I think.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it goes back to Adam and Eve, you know, that they want to be great. They want to be like unto God, which in a way is noble. We want to be godly. But they want to do it in their own way. They reach out and they grasp and try to do it in their own power. And that always leads to abuses and to evil in the world. And I think that's what we're seeing inside the church right now.
Yeah. There was a quote Eugene Peterson talked about how we are made for faith. We are made to put our faith into something. And that's how we're made. And that the created world would support your faith in God. That the whole world kind of supports that. But outside of that, then that's when you start having problems.
Yeah, G.K. Chesterton says, if you don't believe in something, you'll believe in everything. So it opens you up to deceptions.
Your book is number one on Amazon in the Catholic category, number one. And I'm not surprised, because this is, like I said before, this book ticks all the boxes. This really makes it, get you right in the lane. And takes you right forward and is like, what's wrong? You're getting at the root of the problem. Now, you can believe it or not believe it. But the issue is, this is another perspective that will not that brings in the spiritual as well. And I want to get to the decay from within, because it takes time. That kind of – it takes over time. So it takes schooling of generations to accept a slight change of doctrine or interpretation or doctrine. But where in your mind, where does it really start?
Well, of course, I mean, you can back it all the way up to Adam and Eve.
Well, yeah.
Judas Iscariot, but the current crisis.
Right.
So the current crisis that we're seeing, that you read in the newspapers of ex-Cardinal McCarrick or some of the cardinals in Rome or all these things, some people say, well, it's just this current pope, Pope Francis. If that wasn't in the case, it'd all be fixed.
Mm-hmm,
or, you know, if only Benedict the 16th, the previous pope, hadn't resigned. Or,
right.
You know, if only John Paul II could have lived longer. If only there hadn't been Vatican II. So they have these sort of, you know, flashpoints that they want to just hang everything on. And doing research for this book, I saw that it's more like a dimming switch. It's not an on-off switch.
Right, right.
And that this happened not just over 5 years or 10 years or 50 years. This was actually a very long and determined strategy to bring about confusion. And primarily the reason it started in the early 1800s is because from the time of the apostles with, you know, the Emperor Nero, mm-hmm. and then, you know, up through Diocletian, I mean, for about 1700 years, there was constant attacks on Christians.
Right.
And usually the strategy was, let's kill them, right? And then all the Christians would go and, you know, they'd find their body or their bones and they would bury it and they'd build an altar there and a big basilica and it'd become
Saint. Because it's a suffering church.
Yes, it'd be like St. Mark's or, you know, name any saint.
Right.
Like these are, you know, these were these churches were. And so that went on for a very long time. It was never very successful because the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. That's goes back to a guy named Tertullian in the early church. And so, you know, at the French Revolution, there was just this huge attack on the church. I mean, they're just lining up nuns and cutting off their heads at the guillotine, just so much anger. And they're, you know, taking Notre Dame in Paris and stripping it of anything Christian, all crosses and all these things. And what happened is even after Napoleon came, the church returned to France, right?
Mm-hmm.
The people returned back to Christianity and specifically to Catholicism. And so in the 1800s, after the French Revolution, there's this understanding that in order to destroy Christianity, you can't just keep killing them, right?
Right.
You kill a pope, he's a sainted pope.
Right.
Now he's Pope Saint so-and-so.
Right.
So instead, what if we just started to influence the ideas of the children, the schools, the catechisms, and then the seminaries, the monasteries, and the convents? Like, really hit them where it hurts, but you can't just, you know, be very blatant about it. So there's a subtlety involved in it. And so this begins in the 1800s. And already by the mid-1800s, you have popes like Gregory the 16th and Pius the 9th who are becoming aware that already in seminaries and in priestly formation are some of these subversive elements. And so that's where my book begins.
What are some of the subversive elements in the seminaries? Because I remember, you know, Pope Emeritus, Pope Benedict the 16th, issued a letter that was published in the German press, and it was a small German press, and then, of course, it exploded in global, and everybody's been commenting on it, and he talks about the causes of the abuse crisis, and he mentions the seminaries.
Yes.
But it appears as though they're mentioning it within this sort of modern element, like since Vatican II.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you're saying it goes back much further than that.
Yes, it's going back to the 1850s, and I think that's what people find surprising in my book, Infiltration, is they, oh, I thought this was like a, you know, since Woodstock problem.
Yeah.
And it actually goes back further because, I mean, if you even look into the 1800s and just the university system in Europe and America, you see the same thing. And primarily the influence there is a reducing of all things supernatural.
Yes.
So like even if in America you went to Harvard, you know, before the 1800s, it's a divinity school. It's primarily a theological institution. And then after that, you start seeing that that's being replaced and that's being suppressed. So there's a change. And that same thing that's happening in the secular world, but it also starts happening in the church. And so what you see like in the 1860s and in the 1870s, which is a long time ago, you see things being taught, for example, when Jesus multiplied the loaves and the fishes. Nothing metaphysical happened to those bread, pieces of bread and fishes, but everyone had their lunch with them. And they were so inspired by our Lord Jesus Christ and his word. He said, you know what, I'm going to share my sandwich with that person over there. And everyone got food.
Well, see, that's the Unitarian view.
Yes.
Because it's like, oh, it was the miracle of sharing.
It's the miracle of sharing. Exactly. And you know, within the past year, Pope Francis has actually publicly taught that. But you see that already in the 1800s. And it goes by names in the 1800s of like liberalism or rationalism. The popes would refer to it back then as naturalism. So you take anything supernatural and you find a way to naturalize it. Like Jesus didn't walk on water. He was just on the beach and from a distance, you know, it looked like he was walking on water. So all of these things that for 1800 years we saw as miracles and miraculous and supernatural, those start to be eroded. And really by around 1900, you have priests and bishops actually being sanctioned and excommunicated from Rome because they're actually teaching this in public.
Wow.
So those are that's kind of, you know, like we said at the beginning, you know, when you deny the devil, right, he's kind of already got you. So they're denying the supernatural, both the demonic and the divine, you know, of Christ himself. And so that just really starts to grab a foothold. So by the 40s and 50s, it's becoming much more common. And then by the 60s, it's in your face.
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely in your face. You're hearing it in sermons on a Sunday.
Right.
Right.
I mean, the 60s didn't happen in a vacuum.
Precisely.
It had its own sort of, you know, preludes in, you know, the 50s and 40s. And part of that, yes, taking the supernatural out of the faith. And I heard a Southern Baptist preacher or of the Southern Baptist tradition say, you know, once you take the supernatural out of Christianity, you basically just have the Elks Club. You know, it's just
with some charity work.
Yeah, some charity work.
Elks Club with some charity work. Yeah. And people right now. But you have the Elks Club with charity work, but you also are now vulnerable to people who are abusive coming into the quote-unquote Elks Club with charity to use the power and the money to do really bad things like we've seen with these pedophiles and sex scandals.
Right, right.
It's a perfect opportunity for a predator to come in and use this institution. He has no supernatural faith, and he has free access to all these victims.
I want to talk about what you cite in the beginning as really what kind of the three elements of Freemasonry, liberalism, and then modernism. And Freemasonry, I never looked upon it as being dangerous at all, but the Freemasons were what?
So sometimes people hear Freemasons and they're like, uh-oh, this is like crazy conspiracy. Get on your tinfoil hat. And so what I try to do in the book is say, look, there's different names of them, Freemason, Carbonari, depending on what country you live in. But you have to remember in the 1700s, and this is the century in which America was founded. You have a lot of toppling of monarchies in Europe. You have the French Revolution. There were intellectual, very smart men who wanted political revolution. They wanted to see the church subjugated to the state. They wanted the universal brotherhood of man. They were already talking about redistribution of goods. It wasn't full-out Marxism because that comes later in the 1800s. But all these ideas are – to say those ideas in public was dangerous. You lost your academic appointment. You lost your job. You could be killed. So these very smart men had to assemble in secret societies. And these aren't like what you've seen in like the Sherlock Holmes movies of black robes and sacrificing virgins on the altar. I mean, maybe they did that. The main thing you understand is these are very intelligent men meeting in secret, talking about revolutionary ideas that would maybe get them killed in public. And that's what these early groups are. Okay? So you hear Freemasons and you think of, you know, Sherlock Holmes, but maybe just bracket that off and say, okay, these are very smart men in secret societies, and they want to see all Christianity, not just Catholicism, subjugated and weakened. Like, read Voltaire.
Yeah, well, of course, Candide is
exactly.
all about that.
Exactly.
And,
so,
and it sounds really wonderful. I mean, I love the music of Leonard Bernstein. I mean, it's great music. I love the overture to Candide.
Yep.
But the first time seeing the actual play, it's like, oh, that's what we're about.
Right, yeah. It's like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Hobbes, you know, all of these great Enlightenment minds.
Right.
It starts to come out in the public, but originally they had to organize and talk because you can't come on Fox News back in the day and say, hey, I think this would be a great idea. They might come after you and your family. You could get in trouble.
What if I'm going to be devil's advocate here, because if it weren't for – there was an oppressiveness of the church even then. I mean, this is what happened for the Protestant Reformation. The church was not doing what it was supposed to be doing.
Yes.
And so Luther says, hey, I'll give you these 98 theses. Here's some problems in the church. And he expected them to say, oh, thank you very much.
Right.
We didn't know we were being like this, and we'll make those changes now. Thank you very much. And it didn't turn out that way. I mean, they came after him. Are you saying that that in itself is the work of the spiritual forces of evil?
Well, remember, the devil has a plan for everyone, whether you're a pope or Martin Luther or whomever. He doesn't like any of us, right? So he always plays both sides. And I think what you see in the 1500s or pick a century, you always see this infiltration happening. You see popes abusing their power.
Yeah.
You see Christian kings abusing their power. This is always happening. And so the needle is swinging back and forth, right?
Wow.
So, of course, I'm not saying that people need to hide and go into secret to think or discuss. But I think we can see that there were men who, for whatever reason, we don't know their reasons, did have a vision of an atheistic Europe and a Europe without Christianity, without Christ, without the church. And so this was something they wanted to do. And there was a document in the early 1800s called the Permanent Instruction of the Alta Vendita. It's a long name. It's kind of the beginning of my book. And this was written by the Carbonari. They were an Italian secret society.
Right.
And they wanted to see kind of the downfall of the Pope. And so they said, you know, we're never going to get the Pope to come over to our side. So let's take time. Let's be deliberate. This could take a century. Actually took a little more. And let's begin to introduce our ideas, our secular humanist ideas, in schools, in the seminaries. And after 100 years, it'll just be natural for pastors, priests, bishops to say these kinds of things that we hold dear.
I'm kind of getting a chill because it's exactly what's kind of going on today. You wrote The Little Tiger is a pseudonym for a Freemason writer, right? It's the Little Tiger, who talked
Italian.
About the slow forces of the to subvert the church's teachings. And I want to read this quote because I thought it was very – this is your book saying this. The Little Tiger explains how the youth will be seduced over time through the corruption of families, books, poems, colleges, gymnasiums, which I think is high schools.
Yes.
Universities and seminaries. Next, the Catholic clergy will be seduced and corrupted. If someone had bet to name the future, they would have won the lottery on this.
Yes.
Because that's exactly what's happened.
And this is 1840s, 1830s maybe. So they've already have that game plan. And it makes, in the same author says, forget the middle age and the old. We don't have them. So their strategy is very clear. They're like, look, we are that grandma at church, and we lost her. We're not going to get her. But if we go after the young people and we spend a decade on them, over time, we will change society. And, of course, it happened in the Catholic Church. It's happened in Protestant seminaries. It's happened in America. It's happened everywhere. It's a very powerful strategy.
Now, you don't really favor the Protestant Reformation. Being a raised Protestant, I was actually married in the Greek Orthodox Church.
Oh, wow.
And so my husband is still not over the schism of 1054.
Yes.
So, you
Good.
Know,
right?
Yeah. He says he's part of the true church.
Yes, right, right.
But you talk about the corruption with the Protestant Reformation. And I talk about this, you know, there was plenty of corruption already in the Catholic Church. But what do you really see in the Protestant Reformation? I know you kind of mentioned it before, you know, the devil working on both sides. But, you know, hasn't it done some good?
Yeah, I mean, I used to be a Protestant. I used to be an Episcopalian priest. So I've been on both sides of the aisle, right? And so, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, good happens all over, you know, and I don't want to discount that
at
all.
You could actually become a Catholic priest now.
I could.
Yeah.
I could. I was in the process, but I discerned out.
Really?
Yeah. I got
okay.
all these children.
So how do you guys feel about it?
Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Okay.
So I've been on both sides of the aisle, and you know, for me, one of the reasons I became a Catholic is that it just breaks my heart to see so many divisions. There's like 36,000 Protestant denominations. Right. It breaks my heart that we're not in communion with the Greek Orthodox. That's just a tragedy. You know, it just shouldn't be. Christ said, let them all be one.
Yes.
And so I just, you know, just looking at it historically, I am the very first Catholic in the world. I wrote the book on it, of corrupt Catholics, right, and problems in the Catholic Church. So I'm right there, and some of my brothers and sister Catholics have criticized me for that. Like, we shouldn't be so public about this. I think we should be public about it.
Mm-hmm.
All that being said, I kind of look at the Old Testament, and you look at the sins of Solomon, the sins of David, the sins of the high priest, all these horrible worshiping idols, worshiping Ashtoreth poles, all these things in the Old
right.
Testament. And never was it okay to just say, well, we're starting a new Israel. We're going to start this new Israel over on this street corner. Well, we don't like that one. We're going to start this. And so you have multiple Israels. It seems to me that the biblical pattern is, no matter how crummy it gets, stay with the original family, fight it out, try to fix it. So I'm a Catholic, and I'm not at all excited about these corruptions or any of the corruption in the church.
Right.
I just feel that it's part of my vocation to be one with all. And so if the original vehicle of that was the Catholic Church, or Pacha, your husband, maybe the Greek Orthodox, right, we need to strive to have a visible union on earth to the best we can.
You gave your book to Pope Francis. I can't imagine that he probably just jumped with joy about this.
Well, I was at a Wednesday audience, and we were allowed to sit up there on the front row with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought a book with me, and I knew I'd probably be able to meet him, so I wanted to give him a copy. Because the last few chapters do talk about him, the conclave that elected him, and they're pretty controversial. I don't think he would be extremely pleased to read those sections, but I do see him as the Pope. I have deep, deep reservations about some of his policies. I openly disagree with him on my podcast on things, decisions he's made, even things that he's taught, not officially, but just him as a personal theologian. But I feel it's my duty to be friendly, to shake his hand, to smile with him. And, you know, I told him that our family prays the rosary every night. We pray for his intentions, pray for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really spent this past Lent praying for him and hoping for purity in our church and conversions. And, you know, I want these kids to grow up, you know, in a church and knowing Christ, not being embarrassed or scandalized, but just feeling at home with our Lord. You know, that's
right.
That's my heart. That's what I really want. So I gave him the book, and he looked at the table of contents, and we talked very briefly about it. And he kind of looked a little bit concerned until I started telling him about how much we pray for him. And
because the bishop who wrote the foreword, he's not really a fan of either.
Yeah, the bishop who wrote the foreword is Bishop Athanasius Schneider, and he's probably been of the top five most critical bishops in the world of the Pope. So when the Pope saw that name on the cover, I saw his face drop a little bit, because he knew, oh, okay, this kind of book, right? Because just two or three days ago, Bishop Schneider, Cardinal Burke, Cardinal Pujats, and two other bishops released a 40-page clarification for the church and for the Pope. It's got a lot of press. It's very controversial. But yeah. So he was one of those bishops on there as well.
The Syllabus of Errors, this is something that in 1864, what is the Syllabus of Errors that you read about? Because we're still in, the 19th century here.
Yeah. So the Syllabus of Errors was a list of actual philosophical or theological errors that were out in print in the 1800s. And it's a little bit confusing to read because basically the document is these quotes are errors. And then it's just literally quotes, almost like tweets, like how we would think of it today.
Yeah.
And they just paste in the tweets. So they're on all manners of things regarding philosophy, theology.
And they're just errors that are out there in the world.
Errors that have been literally plucked out of writings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that are popular.
And like, what would be some of the errors?
Some of the errors would be some of the things we talked about naturalism, about
right.
Understanding the Word of God as sort of just a collection of historical memoirs of people who weren't inspired. That's one of the errors.
Right. Understanding
the resurrection of Christ as not actual a bodily resurrection, but, you know, a lot of the modernists would later say, or even in that time would say, well, you know, Jesus didn't really rise out of a tomb like it mm-hmm. says in the Bible mm-hmm. on Easter. It's sort of after he died, his followers were really sad. They're like, you know, he taught us a lot of good things, and so he's risen in our hearts.
Mm.
You know, that kind of a thing. So
right.
These are the errors.
Which is really funny. It's not funny at all, because if you actually read the scripture, that's not anything what he said. And the Corinthians talks about, you know, because Paul's writing and saying, you know, Jesus rose and 500 people saw him.
Yes,
and
right.
you can still go see them because they're still eyewitnesses.
Yep.
And you can't interpret that any other way than bodily resurrection.
That's right. That's right. So these are the errors. I mean, another error was that be controversial for Americans is it rejects the separation of church and state. That's one of the errors listed.
Yeah.
Because traditionally, the church would have a distinction between the mayor and the president and the king and the bishop and the pastor and the priest.
Mm-hmm.
So traditionally, you'd say there's an integration and a distinction, but never a separation. So traditionally, the Catholic Church would never condone a separation. So that's one of the errors that would be controversial.
Yeah.
So it has some politics, it has some philosophy, it has some Bible, some theology. That's the Syllabus of Errors.
You talk a lot about the miracles, the appearances, the apparitions. But particularly you spend a lot of time on Fatima.
Mm-hmm.
And Fatima is the famous miracle of Our Lady of Fatima in Portugal, where the Our Lady Mary appears to the three children in the cove. Why do you spend so much time on this miracle?
So when you think about, you know, the history of Europe, you have 1517, Martin Luther, 1770 is really when the secret societies come on the scene in London. And then in 1917 is when you have all this revolution of the monarchies in Europe and the dynasties. And in Catholic tradition, Our Lady appears to these three children in Portugal, 1917, and says, you know, if people don't repent, get in line, there's going to be another war. Obviously, that did happen, World War II.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be, you know, all these problems in the world. The heirs of Russia will spread her ways, and that actually happened that year and the next with the Russian Revolution and the spread of communism. And we know that's the case. We know Russia spread communism to China, Vietnam, Cuba, places in South America. I mean, for the next several decades, we have been trying to chase that problem down, and it was all prophesied and said beforehand. But one of the things that's exotic and, you know, people just find so interesting about Fatima is the Blessed Virgin Mary gave to Lucia a third secret that she cannot tell anyone in the world. And it was put in an envelope and it was sent to Rome. And it said that the Pope, only the Pope, could open that envelope in the year 1960 because then it will be clear. So she wrote this down. Nobody saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1959, Pope John the 23rd, so 1 year early, he opened it and he said, this is not for my time. This is not for my pontificate, and put it away and said, I'm not going to release it to the world. And it was very controversial. Like the New York Times ran a front page story on it in that year. The whole world wanted to know.
Mm.
And it was sort of suppressed. So in the year 2000, the Catholic Church, the Pope did release the third secret, and it's very apocalyptic. It It shows the Pope and cardinals and bishops going up this hill towards a cross. And then there's gunfire and they all are killed. All massive martyrdom. You can go read it anywhere, right? I mean, it's out now. And so this points forward to some kind of crisis, physical, spiritual, whatever. And there's also a lot of debate on whether the document was one pages or several pages and whether they released the whole thing in 2000. There's a lot of people who think not all of it was released. I'm one of those people, and I explain why in the book. So because of that, Fatima and those secrets and this prophecy, and because it foretold so many things, like you can't make it up. So it seems supernatural and genuine, and the church has approved it. It's still something debated today, and it still seems to point towards something. I mean, John Paul II was shot on the feast day of Our Lady of Fatima in St. Peter's Square. I'm sure people remember when he was shot. That happened on the anniversary of Fatima, that very day. So something is going on with that. And, you know, even people who aren't Catholic are interested in this because, you know, it's probably one of the most interesting metaphysical things that happened in the last 100 years.
I only knew about it when I was younger because I saw the movie, the old movie that they made, and I don't think they've ever remade it, but it is a really fascinating film. And then also the news reports about the miracle of the sun, and that's what really gets people is this miracle. Explain what that miracle was.
So she began appearing to the children on the 13th day of May, 1917. Probably because in the Old Testament, in the book of Esther, the people of Israel were delivered from destruction on the 13th day. So it's May 13th, and she appears every month after that. She tells them, keep coming back on the 13th day. And then she says, on October 13th, I will have a great miracle. And these visions were so popular that just thousands, tens of thousands of people were coming to watch these on the 13th day. And on October 13th, there were there's debate, 50 to 70,000 people. Many of them are scoffers. Many of them are communists, atheists, all Freemasons, all kind of scoffers. But on that day, it was raining. The rain stopped. The sun came out. It, according to reports of thousands of people, dried them, and the sun began to turn colors and move. And this great metaphysical thing happened. It seemed to confirm the message that these children were saying that was coming from heaven. So, I mean, it would really – if it's true, and I believe it is true, it would be the biggest public miracle since the crossing of the Red Sea.
Wow.
More people saw it. So it wasn't just like three kids said, I saw this.
Right.
We're talking about 50 – and even atheists in papers were like, I saw – something happened in the sky. This miraculous thing happened. 50 to 70,000 people. So it prophesies interesting things. It seems to have something to do with politics, Russia, the spread of communism in the world. And also something to do with the suffering of the Pope and some sort of horrific apocalyptic mystery.
And was that the shooting of Pope John Paul II, or is there another suffering?
So it says
ahead?
In the Third Secret, it explicitly says that the Pope was killed. He was killed. Yeah. Interesting. It also refers to him as the Bishop of White. We took him to be the Pope, which is an interesting little detail in it. But yeah, in the vision, he died. So it doesn't seem necessarily that Pope John Paul II getting shot. I mean, when they did surgery on John Paul and took the bullet out of him, he went and took that bullet to Fatima, Portugal. It's still there to this day, you know, because he saw it as connected to that. But it doesn't seem – because in the vision, it's him, cardinals, bishops, nuns, even lay people are all shot down and murdered.
Wow. Do you know – I mean, I'm asking you to predict or to read into Fatima – but what does it have to say for our future, the miracles of Fatima? Because we've not really had anything like that since.
You know, there's like the gospel, like scripture, like what Christ teaches, there's always the bad news and there's the good news. Mm-hmm. And as Christians, we believe that the good news wins. Gospel means the good news. Christ preached the good news. And so in the message of Fatima, it says, you know, she asked for people to pray the rosary every day. She asked for the Pope to consecrate Russia. And she asked people just to be holy, you know, and in other ones too, it says, you know, don't take God's name in vain. Don't work on Sunday, just like traditional Christian piety.
Right.
And she says that in the end, her Immaculate Heart will reign. There'll be a great time of peace upon the earth, a great time of spiritual renewal, goodness, blessing, all this, you know, it will come and there will be conversion. So, you know, sometimes people like to focus on the negative and the apocalyptic. And, and I hope in this book as well, I mean, especially as you get to the last two chapters, a lot of hope, a lot of good news. You know, you know, I've got these beautiful 8 children, and I look forward to the future with hope. And I think as Christians, we can only be people of hope, no matter how bad it gets. Whether we're in the catacombs or in the cathedrals, we have to have this hope. And even in that message, it points towards some future event that will be good. That doesn't mean it couldn't get worse in the next 5 to 10 years or 20. But right. I really do believe that God has something great for us.
I want to get to end this because you have a section in the book towards the end called Ratzinger versus Bergoglio. And those who know Cardinal Ratzinger became Pope Benedict XVI, who abdicated and stepped down. And then Cardinal Bergoglio became Pope Francis.
Yes.
So explain this controversy between these two men.
Okay, so when Cardinal Ratzinger was the right-hand man of John Paul II, he's seen as very conservative, very traditional. He wanted to maintain a continuity with the past, a hermeneutic continuity. Mm-hmm. And he continued in many ways a more conservative trajectory from John Paul II. And he won the conclave quickly right away. He went in as the leader and he came out as the Pope, and he was Pope Benedict XVI. We know from other cardinals, for example, Cardinal Daniels, who died earlier this year, and others, even ex-Cardinal McCarrick, who's been shamed and cast out, that going back into the 2000s, there was a group of cardinals and archbishops and influential people who would meet in St. Gallen, Switzerland. And there they made plans to put in their own candidate and to prevent the election of Ratzinger. And if you can read Cardinal Daniels' biography, and he explicitly states this, which was not real smart of him to do. And so it's come to the attention of the public that there was this small group. It could have represented other people, but we just know it's about, I list the names that they list in infiltration, you know, of a dozen people. They meet every year in St. Gallen and they discuss. Well, we've also learned that when Ratzinger was elected, the number two was Bergoglio from South America. And so this, you often see this in papal elections. There'll be a conservative and a kind of a more liberal, often a moderate gets picked, not those two.
Right.
But in this case, it was the conservative, and the next time it was a more liberal, a Latin American, Argentinian, who's Cardinal Bergoglio, who his ethnicity is Italian, but he's raised in Argentina. He's a Jesuit. And the Jesuits especially have always been influenced by academia and tend in our time to be extremely liberal and radical. So he's coming from that theological tradition. Mm-hmm. Also, Latin American Catholicism is often tied up with what's called liberation theology, which is the idea that Christ came primarily not to deliver us from hell, but to deliver us from earthly political suffering. And so it's often wrapped up with political movements, often connected with communist regimes.
Which is really kind of what happened, you know, to Israel when Jesus appeared. They thought he was going to free them from a political oppression, and that had nothing to do with it.
It's a common mistake in spirituality to think if I love God, I'm going to become rich or I'm going to get out of this problem. And often we find that when I love God, there's still problems in our life, and we're called to patiently become more holy. Right. And to stay close to our Lord and to see ourselves conformed with the cross of Jesus. That seems to be the authentic message. But there's always this temptation, as you just mentioned, to see it as some sort of temporal blessing.
This cadre of cardinals or clergy, were they instrumental in sort of forcing Pope Benedict to resign?
So that's really the debate right now in Catholic circles. I mean, that's what all the blogs and podcasts are discussing is, did they actually put pressure on Pope Benedict XVI? And I go through the Vatican. There's been two major Vatican bank scandals. There was one going back to 2010, 2011. Archbishop Vigano, who later on was in America and blew the whistle on McCarrick, but he was also involved in that Vatican bank scandal. And it seems that pressure was put on Pope Benedict both financially and in sex scandals. Allegedly, there are one or two red binders that three cardinals collected that had all kinds of info on the Vatican bank scandal with money laundering. And then also photos and info of senior clergy cardinals in sexually compromised surroundings. So it's said that that's what led Benedict to say, I'm an old man. I can't handle this. I need to step down and let someone else do it.
Did they expect that, you know, the controversy or the conflict or the pressure would just kill him? You know, in which case they would get what they want, or did they even expect that he would ever step down?
I don't know. I don't want to speculate.
Okay.
You know, I like to try to keep to the facts so people can't discount me and say, oh, it's just conspiracy speculations. I honestly don't know what they were thinking, but it seems that there was some kind of an undermining there, either to just – I mean, another option is just keep him quiet. You know, if he's going to do reforms, well, let's just put pressure on him so we kind of bind him.
Mm-hmm.
That's another strategy too. I think that strategy was used more with his predecessor for John Paul II. So I don't really know how the machine of the Vatican works and who's who on pulling those levers.
Yeah, that's a whole
– Yeah, it's something that
profession in itself.
Yeah, exactly. But we do know from their own testimony that they were meeting in St. Gallen, Switzerland, and they were doing this. And the man they wanted became Pope Francis. So they got their guy. And that happened in 2013, so we're 6 years into it. And honestly, I mean, people are saying lifelong Catholics. I've never seen the church embroiled in so much controversy.
What do you think is – I mean, you think this clergy sexual abuse crisis is – part and parcel, really, of the sort of, you know, I don't want to say satanic attack, but just sort of the spiritual forces of evil, that sort of thing. And I know people are going to think, oh, Lauren, what are you talking about? You're a journalist, you know, and the spiritual forces of evil. What is that about? But what is happening in your mind with this clergy sex abuse crisis, and why can they not seem to root it out no matter what they do?
Well, you know, last year the United States bishops met in Baltimore. And they went for a vote whether there should be a continued investigation on Cardinal McCarrick. And for people listening, they're like, who's Cardinal McCarrick? Cardinal McCarrick was the Cardinal of Washington, D.C., the number one priest, bishop, archbishop, metropolitan of the United States.
Right.
Lots of connections in Rome. I mean,
raised a lot of money.
That's one thing. He raised a ton of money and was also known for having the most vocations, the most priests in the seminary in his group. So he was just a superstar. He was a rock star. And then last year in the summer of shame, you know, the New York Times broke this story that he molested a young man right down the street at St. Patrick's Cathedral in the sacristy on Christmas Eve, and a bunch of other stories. I broke a story on my podcast with James Grine, who was one of his primary victims for many years. Molested him in the confessional, all kinds of just horrific, heartbreaking stories. So here was a man who was the number one guy and a complete fraud. We're talking about financial, millions of dollars, embezzlement, molestations, young men. There's trips of him going out to the beach house with young priests and all kinds of scary things happen of, you know, him jumping into bed with him. All these horrible things were happening. And so people since last year have said, why did this happen? And an insider, Archbishop Vigano, who's the ambassador between the Holy See, Rome, and United States, he has said, I was given instructions by Benedict XVI to put sanctions and restrictions on McCarrick because it was found out. They were trying to keep it secret.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I was gone, I met with Pope Francis, and Francis took off the restrictions and the sanctions on McCarrick. And that's been the controversy. And Vigano said the Pope should resign. He knew about it, and he removed the sanctions, and the whole thing blew out into the American public and now the world.
And the Pope, he says he didn't know.
Now he says that, yes.
Now he says he did not know.
At first he says, I will not say one word when they had on the airplane. I will not say one word. And now he's saying he doesn't recall. And last Friday, Vigano put out an interview with the Washington Post, and he says, no, he's lying. He knew. I remember the conversations I had with Pope Francis on it. So this is a big deal.
Yeah. I don't foresee. I mean, maybe you foresee. I don't foresee another second pope stepping down.
You know, it's funny. I when this whole thing broke, I thought, oh, Pope Francis is going to have to resign. He has to step down. There's no way. But now that we've been in it for a while, and I've been studying it and following him on a daily basis, I don't think he'll step down. I think he'll write it out. But who knows?
Do you think he'll go back to Pope Benedict? And it's like, oh, well, you're pope now.
Well, it's funny because there's a big debate now. Is Benedict still the pope? Is, you know. Was that an invalid resignation? Was it an invalid election? Was it coerced? So now all these people are are speculating on that. And I address that some at the end of this book, mm-hmm. and try to put some of that speculation to rest. But because of just how emotional this is for people.
Right.
And I mean, remember, like for a normal Catholic, there's two main pastors in their life. Their local pastor who they know, who baptizes their kids and can, you know, and first mm-hmm. communions and funerals. That's who they know.
Right.
Father McGillicuddy and the Pope. Like
right.
that's their compass.
Right.
You know, for forever. That's how it's been. And now to see so much controversy and scandal with the top one, with the Pope, is, you know, people are leaving the church, people are confused, they're no longer giving money. There's anger, there's sorrow, there's suffering. So what I want to do with this book, Infiltration, is say, yes, it's really bad. It's been a long game for our enemies. They've had a long strategy. We have to diagnose it and mm-hmm. understand it. And then at the end of the book, I give recommendations on how we can rebuild.
Well, it's going to be very interesting. The book is called Infiltration, The Plot to Destroy the Church from Within. Dr. Taylor Marshall, you can check out your podcast as well. What is it's just the podcast is called Dr. Taylor Marshall, right?
Yeah, Dr. Taylor Marshall Show. It's on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube.
And you've got such a wonderful voice to listen to, too.
Thanks.
So it would be a pleasure to listen to your podcast. So I want to thank you so much for being on a Lighthouse Faith podcast, because this has been a fascinating conversation. And certainly not uncontroversial, because you're raising a lot of issues within the church. And, of course, a lot of spiritual issues that many modern people just, you know, don't accept. You know, if you can't measure it in science, it can't exist. So this will be, you know, a controversy on that level. But as you say in the book, if you don't believe in Satan, don't read the book. It's
right.
just not going to work for
but
you.
But if you do, read the book.
You might want to read the book. You might want. And also pick up the Screwtape Letters. You know, that's another.
Exactly. Yeah, read them together for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Dr. Taylor Marshall, thank you so much for being on the Lighthouse Faith podcast. And I'm Lauren Green. Thanks for listening.